Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 20, delivered on April 12, 2017. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. The culmination of the course, to some extent, the last and best, and it's actually a very simple formula. The math behind it to get to it is surprisingly daunting. If I recall right, I didn't see the full math of it until I got into grad work. But anyway, I want to start this out with something that seems like it doesn't have anything to do with that. It's almost like political science, political theory. But it motivates what the CAPM is all about and why it came into existence, this capital asset pricing model. Back, World War II was one of our great achievements. The can-do Americans went in, kicked Nazis all over the place, wiped out the Japanese Imperial Army, and we came out of that war thinking that we could do anything that we wanted. And there were a lot of people who came out of that war with that idea that this was the can-do. And rather quickly, we began to understand that the end of the war against the Nazis and the Hirohito's troops was not the end of war. We were facing a new menace, the Soviet Union. The dark cloud moving across Eastern Europe, as it were. Well, now in the 1950s, we had a president of general, Dwight Eisenhower. Sometimes I call him the last great Republican president. He was a real moderate all through everything. In his last speech to Congress, his farewell address, he gave this ominous warning. He said, "Beware the military-industrial complex." This is a general, you know, one of the guys who was the military personified. And yet here, there he was saying, beware the military-industrial complex. He meant by that he wanted the American society to be a place where fierce competition of small and mid-sized companies was the rule, that there was no corporations could not grow so large that they could control prices and all that kind of stuff. You learn in economics, monopolies can set prices and lower product, lower output levels. And he was adamant that we needed to avoid a world where there were these giant corporations running the show. Unfortunately for him, the next president was a brash young man who had been a war hero in World War II. His name was Jack Kennedy. And Jack Kennedy was one of those guys who believed we could do whatever the hell we needed to. We could. He actually, in one of his very early speeches when he became president in 1961, he said, "We will put a man on the moon by the end of the decade." And at that time, you know, rocket scientists were saying, "Yeah, right, Jack, you're not kidding. Are you out of your mind? No, we can't do that." Well, he believed that we could, and we could do anything we put our mind to, including facing down the Soviet Union in all of its militaristic expansion and its awful treatment of humans and all that. The idea behind what came to be known as neoliberalism was that you can't do this with little tiny competitors. Not everything can be like that. Their belief was that you could let corporations become very large, but you had to have countervailing forces to keep them in check. So you had a triangle that needed to be fostered of a large, powerful government, large, powerful corporations, and large, powerful unions. And they would create what one economist, a Nobel Prize winner, called a system of countervailing forces, so that no one of them could get out of control without the others putting it back in check. That's a backdrop. So now as we reeled forward through the 1960s into the 1970s, there were some huge corporations that were allowed to become huge corporations. North American Rockwell, the General Motors, the companies that were industrial, military, you name it. Large utility companies that could have control of entire regions monopolistically. But they would be regulated. They would be under an iron fist of control. They couldn't abuse the people in general because the government represented the people. They couldn't abuse the workers because the workers were represented by heavy-duty, vicious unions of power. So that system of countervailing forces was the theory that drove the great American expansion of the 1960s and 70s. And it was hellaciously awesome. And it was effective in maintaining at least a reasonable amount of force against the Soviet Union's expansionism. Communism would face a viable, powerful force against it. Okay, now, taking this to the area of finance, we go to the idea that monopolies and oligopolies raise prices. You learned that in economics. Now, there are these economists who try to say, oh, that's not how it works. Oh, like hell it doesn't. They'll jack up their prices by lowering production. You learn that in basic economics, and it doesn't change just because someone stomps his feet and says, no, that's not how it works. It does. So if you're not going to allow corporations to raise their prices, then you have to regulate their prices. You have to regulate the rates of return that they get on their investments and on their sales and all that kind of stuff. That's where we have that countervailing force of the government. And I'll take this to the level of utilities because this is where the story gets more to this lecture. You see, utilities traditionally are given a monopoly over a region. One utility company provides all of the electricity, for example, to a certain region. It is granted monopoly power, monopoly rights. No other electricity company can come in and compete against it. Wonderful idea, because that's just a guarantee that prices are going to go through the roof, because no competition, the utility company can charge whatever it wants. So that's where the regulation comes in. The regulators required that these utility companies get permission for the prices that they charged utility customers. Now, the way they did this was that the utility company would submit to the regulator what they consider to be a fair rate of return for their stockholders, for their investors. And the commissions, the regulatory commission, would look at that and say yes or no. It was a negotiation. So a utility company could go for its rate approval and say, our investors merit a return on their investment of, let's say, 8.5%. And so we will price our electricity to them so that our stockholders get this as their fair return. And the regulators would come back. Oftentimes there was an incestuous relationship. These utility companies would contribute to the political campaigns. They would buy the plane tickets for the golf outings and all that. So there was a lot of lack of arm's length negotiation. The regulators might come back and say, no, we think you should get 7.2%. And so back and forth they go, and the regulator and the utility company would say, we are not going to be able to keep our investors at anything less than 8.2%, because if we go below that, our investors will go to other stocks and invest in those and sell our stock. This is what we've learned in this class. And a lot of times, this was just, okay, 8.2%, that's cool. In other words, the formation of price was not supply and demand, that blind market forces. It was a negotiation between pals, buddies. This is the way it was through the 60s and 70s. Enter finance, and economics, which had turned into sciences. By this time, they were full sciences. The math, the graph, the whole nine yards, the logical arguments, and all that kind of great stuff, which had been around for a long time, but the math was hard math now. It was the same math you do in physics kind of stuff. And entered two economists, financial economists, who wrote a ridiculously complicated paper. I actually was able to plow through it before graduate school, but we had to understand it in PhD work. They wrote a formula that said, rates of return are not a negotiation. Rates of return are not some gut process or some feel-good process or some thing that comes out of talking back and forth. Prices form in a market by the same forces that balance things in nature itself, mathematics. And they found the equation that actually drives rates of return. It's a mathematical formula. And they put it in one of the biggest papers that was ever published in finance. It's called the Capital Asset Pricing Model, CAPM. The Capital Asset Pricing Model. And it is actually, surprisingly, simple. Now, this is expectations. These R's that I'm going to write, returns, are expected for the most part. The expected return on a security is going to equal the risk-free rate plus the beta of the security times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. R sub S equals R sub F plus beta sub S times the quantity R sub M minus R sub F. Now let me write down the pieces of this. R sub F, again, the expected return to a specific security or portfolio . Now, I could actually expand this and say the expected return to an asset, because we can use a CAPM for just straight up projects. We do it right. R sub F is the risk-free rate. Now, the risk-free rate is actually a theoretical animal, but we can proxy it by a treasury bill because they're so close to being risk-free that they're basically risk-free. Beta sub S is just the beta of a security. I've shown you these over and over again. The beta of the security or portfolio. You've seen them, they're published by many services. We can get them anywhere. Now, here is the piece that's interesting. This R sub M, that is the expected return to the market portfolio. Now, again, the R sub F is that risk-free rate right there, showing up again. Now, let me explain the pieces of this very specifically to you, and I'm going to actually tell you a question I'm going to ask on exam two. I'm going to tell you. Now, that's why they call me Pizza Hut, because I deliver. You used to call me that because I had bad acne. But anyway, I hated people, my peers. I hated them. Okay. Okay. Now, the risk-free rate, as I said, it's a theoretical thing, but we can certainly find something that's awfully, awfully close to it. Now, I usually use the current rate on a one-year T-bill, and we'll use one in class here. I'll pull one up and just use it for one. So we can get that one. That one's not hard. Now, the beta sub S is the non-diversifiable risk of the security relative to the market portfolio. Beta sub S is the non-diversifiable risk of the security relative to the market portfolio. I am going to ask you that on exam two. You write exactly what I wrote, gave you there, and you will get all of the points for that question. You want me to repeat it? I thought so. I knew where that was going. Beta sub S is the non-diversifiable risk of a security relative to the market portfolio. You have to include the non-diversifiable part, because this isn't the total risk. It is the non-diversifiable part of the risk. It's that risk that is measured, and it's relative to the market portfolio, because that's the pivot for everything. So if I tell you that a beta of a stock is 0.75, that means it has 75% of the non-diversifiable risk of the market. I will ask you that. You will, if you answer that one and get it, just say what I said, you will not go home empty-handed. You will have a 25% on your exam. That's enough for your mom to put it on the refrigerator. Or not. No, seriously, Mom, 25% was the highest score on that exam. Anyway. Now, this part right here, let me explain this. This R sub M minus R sub F is the expected premium of the market portfolio over the risk-free rate. In other words, when I take the expected premium, expected return of the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate, that is your extra reward for taking the market risk instead of no risk. Again, that is the market premium is what you expect to get. It's what you expect to get by investing in the market portfolio instead of investing in a risk-free instrument. See, if you invest in a risk-free instrument, that's just basically, well, good for you. You're a wuss. But if you invest in the market, you're putting yourself at risk. So the extra R sub M minus R sub F is your reward for taking on risk. Now, let me explain a little further. R sub F, we get, we can just look at treasury bill rates, the yields on treasury, short-term treasuries. The R sub M, the expected return to the market portfolio, is a forward-looking expectation of what the world markets are going to do. Now, there are a number of services that publish on a relatively regular basis the what they think the expected return to the market portfolio is going to be. In fact, I am one of the contributors to one of those estimates. It's a European university that polls financial economists. And there are other services that you can go to. You can, I think you could even type in Google, what is the expected return to the market portfolio, or what is the current expected return to the market, and you'll see different groups survey experts in academia, in finance, in business, and they put their survey, they get the average of their participants, and they publish it. Like, let me give you a specific example, and I'm not absolutely sure the numbers are right, but the last one they did was, in my service, was in February. I said it was in March in the other class, but now I'm beginning to realize I think that was in late February. I got the information for the current cycle. But they said, all right, what is it? And my group has 70 people in it who give their estimates. And my estimate was 7.8%. Okay? You had some in the group, a few, that were still giving like 13.1% for what they expected a market portfolio to yield over the coming year. Real high still. And then you had a few real sourpusses who said it was like 4.9% and all that. So I was kind of somewhere in the middle. Interestingly, the actual average that they published was not too much higher than mine. The actual one was, I think, 8.12%. And I'll be using 8.1% just rounded because I'm not sure of that last decimal point for the ones we'll do so I can show you some examples. But these are the best that we can do based upon the knowledge that we have, our experience with markets, and what we know about future, intermediate future conditions. Okay. Now let me just give you an example here. Wait, give me a second here. Let me pull up. Just a quick couple of securities. First things first, though. I'm going to log in here. Okay, here we go. Now, the first thing I'm going to show you, let's get a current Treasury bill yield. No, that's not bad. That'll do. Okay. Now, the government keeps a nice website. It's one of the out of the Treasury. But heaven knows, I'm not going to remember the. So I'm going to type in Google, Treasury yields. Yeah, there it is. Okay, so now, if I'm looking at the 1 years, I usually use a 1 year. I'm going to say something about that in a minute here, an important caveat. But as you can see, yields pushed upward over the last few days, and they've settled back a little bit now. But the trend is upward. Keep that in mind. The Fed is beginning to do the open market operations to clamp down on the money supply. So interest rates are going up in general, and the yield is going up on these. Okay, so right now, R sub F, I would use 1.04%. Okay, R sub F, I would use 1.04%. Now, R sub M, the service that I work with, I'm going to put it in as 8.1%. I think that's what I'm pretty sure that's what it is to one decimal place. Okay, so now we can find the discount rate to use for securities. Okay, how about this one? Find the discount rate for cash flows from Caterpillar. Okay, can do. Let's take finance.yahoo.com. Let's claw our way in. Cat. Beta of 1.62, so let's have a look. For the beta of CAT would be 1.62, so the CAP M would say that the expected return to Caterpillar, R sub CAT, is going to equal 1.04% plus the beta of CAT, 1.64, times 8.1% minus 1.04%. Before I go on, let me make sure you know what we're talking about here. Notice that the capital asset pricing model says that no security should be expected to pay less than the risk-free rate. In other words, that's like the substrate of all returns. You wouldn't get rid of a security that paid you less than a risk-free security. So risk-free rate is the bottom line. And every other security should have an interest rate higher than that. Okay, so now, also over here, 8.1% minus 1.04%. Let me do that real quick here, because I'm not going to even try to trust myself on that. Okay, so we've got 8.1 minus 1.04, 7.06. What that says, that you should get you deserve an additional. If you invest in the world market portfolio, instead of being a coward and investing in a risk-free instrument, you deserve an additional reward, an extra reward, a marginal reward of 7.06%. No doubt about it. And notice what beta does. Beta is actually a scaling factor. It magnifies or demagnifies your expected market premium over risk-free. That's all CAPM does. And I should point this out right now. You see the capital asset pricing model, R sub S equals R sub F plus beta sub S times the quantity R sub M minus R sub F. If you were thinking of getting a TAT, you can't go wrong with the cap M. Really? Okay?
I'll do it.
Yeah. Good. Talk to me after class. I know a guy named Nick. Yeah. They call him Nick because it kind of nicks sometimes. It just adds some color to the TAT. No charge. Good. Okay. Anyway, this is the CAPM, and I've just applied it. Now, if I honk this thing out, just do the whole thing from scratch, I would do 1.04 times 1.62 times the quantity. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. I was a plus there. Let me clear that. 1.04 plus 1.62 times, open parenthesis, 8.1 minus 1.04, close the parenthesis, equals 12.48% is your expected return to CAT. Notice this. Because you see the CAT has a higher beta than 1. It is riskier than the market. And the market pays 8.1%. Well, CAT will pay, you expect CAT to pay more. That doesn't mean it will, that means you expect it to. The market expects CAT to provide more because it is riskier than the market. That doesn't mean it will, that's why we say it's an expected. And that is the one that we would use for discounting cash flows of CAT. If we had something where we had to do a value of a project in CAT or something like that, we would use 12.48%. All along, if you remember, I've been kind of, well, we're going to discount these at 8.5% or something like that. I pulled out a number out of the thin air. Well, now you see there was, we can do it. We actually can do it. Now, taking this back to the story that I was telling you before, in the 1970s, the regulators realized that this negotiation that they had done with utility companies for rates, with airlines for passenger fares, with all kinds of different things, where it had always been, well, the company says what it needs, the regulators say what they should have, and they talk back and forth. The regulators realized that this isn't the way it's supposed to be done. This is science. This is math. This isn't some feely, touchy thing, touchy-feely, feel-good thing. We can figure out exactly what the fair rate of return is by the capital asset pricing model. Oh, you should have heard the utility companies, because there were utility companies. They had been saying all this time, oh, we need this 8.5%, but oh, God, I guess we'll just have to live with 8.2%. CAPM was pulling in rates like 4.4%, 3.6%. The CAPM was revealing that all along, the rates that were being allowed for return on investment with these utility companies were ludicrously high compared to what they should have been. God, you should have heard the screaming from the utility companies and the airlines. Oh, how could you do that? Oh, God, we're all going to die. And they went to the courts, and the courts sided with the utilities. This capital asset pricing model is nothing but an academic exercise. It's never going to be used for anything, blah, blah, blah. And it was primarily because judges or lawyers were traditionally not trained in physics, in math, in engineering. They didn't understand. This isn't a negotiation. This is science. This is fact. It took until the 1980s before you started getting courts grasping that this was the way it should have been done all along. So there you are. Essentially, the thing was that these utility companies were ultra safe. They had protected monopoly markets. What could go wrong in a company like that? So they were a lot safer than these high rates of return that they said they had to give to their investors. They said, if we don't give these high rates to our investors, the investors will flee to other stocks that will give them higher returns. Well, that's, of course, that's finance, but that didn't mean that that was what was going to happen. It's because these stocks were super safe, so investors would invest based upon the risk of those companies. Okay, now, let me take another one. And I'm just going to do this a couple of times here. Clear that. Now, let me get up here Netflix, NFLX. Which has a beta of 0.77. The beta of NFLX is 0.77. Okay? So now we can get the CAPM use the CAPM on. And we know now, in this case, we see that Netflix is safer than the market portfolio. So we should expect a rate of return on this that would be below 8.1%. In other words, beta will demagnify this stock. And quite honestly, all you have to do in the formula is change the beta. Everything else will stay the same. NFLX, R sub NFLX, will be 1.04% plus 0.77% times the quantity 8.1% minus 1.04%. everything will stay the same. The market line, as long as R sub M and R sub F stay the same, then the market line, the capital market line, will remain in place. Beta is just the independent variable, and R sub S is the dependent variable. But honking that one out real quick here. God, I hate these ads. They just keep flipping and twitching and farting. And there's someone talking. And okay. Netflix, really? Close to reaching 100 million? Well, if they keep canceling series like Longmire, I won't go with them anymore. Anyway, sorry. NFLX. Yeah, zero. There's NFLX. Okay, so now I'll just pull up and we'll honk it out again. 1.04%, what every stock should pay, plus open parenthesis. Whoops. Let's try that again. 1.04% plus 0.77 times, open parenthesis, 8.1 minus 1.04. By the way, notice that it's okay to use percentages as long as you use them for all of the interest rates. Don't use a percentage for the beta. And did I say equals? Nope. 6.48%. As we expected, because Netflix does not have as much non-diversifiable risk as the market, it will pay. We expect it to pay less than the market. That doesn't mean it will, but all we've got for the future are expectations. That is the best way to cover ourselves if someone says in retrospect, well, you used this and it turned out to be this. Yes, we used best practices. So get off my butt about it. So anyway, here we go. Netflix is below the market portfolio. As far as what you expect to return that to return in a well-diversified portfolio. Okay? Actually, even if you don't have a well-diversified portfolio, that's what you should expect it to return. The rest, well, actually, I shouldn't say that because you could get creamed on the diversifiable risk. Okay, so now imagine it with a stock like Target, which has, what was Target? It was way down there, wasn't it? If I remember, TGT, yeah, 0.24. So that one would have even less, 0.24. Okay, now, really? Okay. So now, I'm trying to think of what I was going to, okay. Now, let's go back here, just real quick, for a quick comment on the expected return to the market on Treasury yields. For years, ever since I had been doing this, even in grad school, we would get the yields on one-year T-bills. That was a good risk-free rate proxy. Problem was about, it's probably been, I think it's been like 7 years ago, five, 7 years ago, I was at a kind of like a dinner and a working dinner, and a couple of the financial people there were pulling a discount rate that was not, I'm sorry, a treasury yield that was not the one I was using. And I said, well, why are you using, I don't understand. You got getting different numbers coming out. We're using the same numbers coming in. We went through our numbers and they said, oh, that's your R sub F is wrong. And I said, no, that was a treasury yield at the closing belt at the end of the day today. I said, let me see that. And they said, oh, no. You must be one of those old geezers, which really ticked me off. He said, no one's been using one-year T-bill yields for the last 5 years. And I said, I didn't hear anything. That's news to me. What are you using, 3 months, 1 month? He said, no, we're using 10-year T-bill yields, treasury note yields. I said, you shouldn't use those. Those are long-term. Even though they're risk-free technically, they've got maturity risk premium in them. They said, well, that doesn't matter. Most projects that we would analyze would not be one-year projects. They would be multi-year cash flows. Some might be a couple of years, some might be 20, 30 years. So the prevailing best practice, as they said, was to use a 10-year for R sub F. In other words, I wouldn't use 1.04, I'd use 2.28. And they were very good at what they did. And so I just checked around, and turned out I was way behind the curve. The best practices these days is actually to use the 10-year instead of the 1-year. You notice in the calculations I did, I used the 1-year, 1.04. But like I said, right now, best practices would be, if I were doing this for actual calculations, I'd probably be using a 2.28 for the R sub F, which would actually lower the expected return. Okay. Okay. That's that. That's that part right there. So here we are. We've got a way now. The engineering, financial, physics, whatever you want to call it, the way that we can now find discount rates, the interest rate. What interest rate do we use and all of that kind of stuff? And we can use this for a lot of different kinds of things. Discounting cash flows from projects, discounting cash flows from dividends, finding the stock price. This is how we do it. There's a modern, very modern method that's just coming along that I try to slightly introduce to my students in their final course in finance, but it's mostly in the grad world right now. But this is still used in business. This is the one that is used. Now, let me show you graphically something. Ma'am, I want you to go into your dark, dark past. That awful place that happened to you a few years ago. It was called high school algebra. Okay? And somewhere in your algebra learning, those maths you took in high school, they showed you a formula or an equation, y equals mx plus b, the slope-intercept form of the linear equation. And it's one of those things, oh God, where would I ever use this in life? And reasonably, some of the things that we teach in math, and I taught math for years, honestly, there are a lot of things that you would never use, or at least most people wouldn't. Although now that you guys are becoming professionals, you'll be surprised at some of the weird things you learned over the years in math that show up. But the linear equation shows up in math, in physics, in business, all the time in different ways. And sometimes it kind of hides itself. It doesn't look like a linear equation, because we write the thing in an odd way. But the y equals mx plus b, the y is the dependent variable, the m was the slope of the line, x was the independent variable, what drove the process, and the b was the y-intercept, the intercept on the vertical axis. The capital asset pricing model is nothing but a fancy linear equation with lots of weird variables, weird stuff in it, letters, to make it look like it's not something from high school. All that math that nearly tore us apart trying to figure out what these guys were doing in that original paper, that was some serious math they did. And it all boils down to a high school formula, cap M. Let me show you. The Y. That is nothing but the R sub S, what we're trying to find, the discount, the yield, the expected yield, the expected discount rate, whatever. The X is nothing but the beta. What drives the rate is beta. The slope is nothing but the R sub M minus R sub F. And the B is the R sub F. It's just a linear equation in a weird form. R sub f is where the line crosses the y-axis. In other words, that's the point 0, comma R sub f. For no risk, beta is on the vertical axis, R sub s is on the vertical axis, beta is on the horizontal axis, I should say. The y-intercept is where there's no risk, 0 beta, you'll get the risk-free rate. Another point on it is if beta is 1, if beta is 1, you would get R sub m. So in other words, that point is 1, R sub m, the expected return to the market portfolio. Now, trust me, I'm going to do this again next week. I'm going to go through this a couple of times, just so you get comfortable with how it works. Because once you know how the line works, you have a powerful tool for predicting economic and financial activity. Look, every line needs 2 points to define it. That thing right there is called the security market line. For a given R sub m and R sub f, it's fixed in space, and then we can tell. So, for example, Caterpillar at 1.62 would have a return up there, whatever that was that I got for it, like 12 point something. Netflix has about 0.77, so the line would tell me that its rate would be down there at about 6.5%. So all it is, just a straight line. So for a given, if R sub m and R sub f are fixed and all you're doing is finding expected returns for different betas of securities, you've got a fixed security market line. Security market line. And again, a lot of times this doesn't soak in. God, I was in grad school when they were showing this, and at first I didn't, why are you showing me this? I don't quite get this, but it does kind of come to you. And what I'm going to show you now is security market line dynamics. The dynamics, how you know, thing that I brought up early in the course, like flight to quality. You know, when things get bad, investors move towards safer stocks and bonds and stuff like that. Well, you're going to see it here in just a second. And we're going to talk about it in the context of the real world, what's happening right now, right now. The Federal Reserve has finally gotten the guts to start pushing up the rate that it can push up. The rate that it can push upward is the Treasury bill rate, R sub F, approximately R sub F. It's going up. I mean, last semester when I was doing this, I did a one-year T-bill, and I think I remember using the one-year T-bill was 0.3%. So since one semester, the rate has gone from 0.3% up to 1.04%. So R sub F is on the way up. R sub F is on the way up. So now, if I were to say, okay, let's suppose in a kind of an unrealistic world that we had the expected return to the market portfolio, the world's markets were not going to react to interest rates going up at the risk-free level. In other words, I am wrong to say a year ago, my estimate of the return to the market portfolio was 13.5%. This time, when I just got polled in late February, or maybe it was early March, I said it was 7.8%. In my perspective, R sub M is the expected return to the world markets is falling, and it's falling severely. But let's say I am completely wrong and R sub m is going to stay right where it is. In other words, a beta of 1 is going to still deliver R sub m at that level. 13.5% or something like that. But the Fed, I cannot say the Fed is not raising R sub F. R sub F is unquestionably going up. R sub F1, suppose that R sub F1 goes up to R sub F2. So in other words, the y-intercept goes upward, but that pivot line 1, R sub M stays the same. Let's see what happens to the security market line. Do you see how it's going to pivot up and the fulcrum will be right there at a beta of 1? If R sub M doesn't go down, then that point is going to be a pivot. So R sub F, the Fed is going to push R sub F up. So that's going to wheel the security market line around 1, R sub M. 1, 13.5%, for example. Okay, so look what happens to securities. A stock that had a beta higher than 1 would have delivered that rate. But if it's on the new line, that beta up there, maybe 1.2, do you see how the rate expected return to that stock goes down? Even if the world market portfolio's return doesn't budge, stocks that have higher risk than the world portfolio will suffer. And that means that you will see investors moving away from them because they're not giving as much as they were before. Notice something else that's even more interesting. Stocks with betas below 1. Look at this stock here. This beta was right here, maybe about 0.5. It was delivering an expected return there. Now that the security market line has wheeled upward, pivoted, that stock is actually providing a better return than it did before. In other words, if R sub F goes up, but the world portfolio's expected return stays the same, you'll see stocks that are safer than the world portfolio begin to yield more than they did. And stocks that are riskier than the world market portfolio will give returns that were worse than what they were before. That's not a that's kind of complicated to look at, but if you look at it enough, you'll see that is what would drive a flight to quality. In other words, if investors see that riskier stocks start performing less well, worse, but safer stocks start performing better, you'll see investors pulling away from risk and going towards safety, the flight to quality that I talked about before. Remember, from stocks to bonds, bonds to gold, all that kind of stuff. Investors will move toward stocks that are safer. Flight to quality. Yes. Well, that's an interesting point you're making there, is that what will happen is that as investors pull back their horns, they're going to go towards safer things. And that means that lower risk things will become more attractive. Companies will not be as willing to take risk. That might not be such a good thing, but there is an upside to this. Safe investments include things like Target, 0.27, Netflix, 0.77, 0.24, Netflix, 0.77. But they also include things like CDs. CDs at their best don't pay crap. But I mean, if they start going up, CD yields start going up, while your risky stocks start going down in expected yield, you're going to see people moving their money back into banks. Banks will have more money to lend. That will be a balancing force because money moving into them will slow down the rise in interest rates as the supply of lendable funds goes up. So yes, absolutely, there is a dampening effect because investors are not going to run toward danger. They're going to run away from it. Only the crazy mofos in the investment world run toward risk. It's like horses. We get them out of the burning barn, they go back in. You mindless horse, But normal investors don't do that. They move away from risk. We are risk averse. And so that's actually a good thing. The bad part of it is, though, that the great innovations are not riskless. They are risky. Target, I mean, what's Target done lately that's risky? Oh, it sold a new brand of toilet paper. Oh my, they opened up a grocery section. I mean, that's not changing the world. Changing the world is building private space rockets and designing new generations of computers that with super abilities and all that. So we're going to move away in recessions, in dangerous environments. We stop being the innovators that make us great, which is good sometimes because sometimes innovation leads to great things, but sometimes it leads to things like dubstep and Justin Bieber. Oh, I'm sorry, oh, I shouldn't say it. God, and Twilight. No, I just got to stop. Where the hell? Oh, okay, now, before I get myself in trouble with people who like that. Okay. Now I'm going to show you another, a more interesting scenario, a more realistic one. A more realistic scenario is this one right here. What really will be happening? Okay, we've got the risk-free rate, R sub F. We've got the beta of 1.0, the world market portfolio. Now, the point here, when the treasury rate was 1, we had 0, R sub F 1. Okay, and the market portfolio, let's say its rate was up here, R sub M, expected return to the market portfolio. So its point was right there. 2 points will define any straight line. So there was the original line right there, okay? Now remember that the R sub M minus R sub F is the slope of this line. So if R sub F goes up and R sub M goes down, the slope is going to flatten. Put another way, suppose that the Fed does push up R sub F, the Treasury bill rate, but at the same time, the world market portfolio begins to falter, it begins to fail, it begins to look worse, like I say it will. I may not be right, but most of the economists and finance people and all those gurus, we're pretty much sure that the world market portfolio is going to slide in return. We expect it to. From 13.5 down to 8.1, whatever. It's going to falter. So R sub M, a beta of 1, will be associated with this point down here. Instead of 1, R sub M 1, we'll have 1, R sub M 2, a lower R sub M, a lower value. So notice what happens in this case to the security market line. Whoops, don't turn. It's similar to what happens. Look over here. See this one? It's similar to that one. But the pivot stayed so that it was only higher risk stocks than 1 that took the beating. Stocks with lower non-diversifiable risk than 1 improved. In this case, where both the risk-free rate goes up and the expected return to the world market portfolio goes down, it's like an exacerbated, magnified version of that one. Notice that even stocks that are safer than a beta of 1 start getting punished. But stocks that are super safe start really doing well. That's like a magnified version of the flight to quality effect. This is the one probably that we're going to see. It's not going to be that stocks that are riskier than the market go down and stocks that are have lower yields and stocks that are safer than the market portfolio go up in yield. It's probably going to be the case that definitely stocks that have betas higher than one will lose yield, have lower expected yield. But it's also stocks that even stocks like betas 0.77 would start to have problems. You would probably have to pull back more to target as an investment, CDs as an investment, things like that as investments. Because anything that has much risk at all, depending upon how much this falls, notice if this R-sub-M falls a lot, boy, you really have to pull back a lot to start getting better yields. If it falls, if R sub M falls a little bit, well, just get below about 0.8 and you're okay. So, and the other thing, of course, is it also depends on how much R sub F goes up. If R sub F goes up to more of its, okay, historically, R sub F right now is still very low. Normally, over the course of my life, I was using R sub F's that were like 2.5%. So 1.04%, that's still awfully small. So we could expect R sub F to double over the next year, year and a half, pushing that up quite a bit, which would mean that line would not just pivot downward, but it would slide inward quite a bit, which would mean that you would see a real serious flight to quality, a pullback of some noticeable magnitude in the real realistic terms. Now, that can take you into the world, and it's dangerous territory to play with it. But it takes you partly for your own purposes into the world of what investments are going to be smart investments. Smart investments would probably be investments at first, probably those, because R sub F really isn't moving up that aggressively yet, probably just getting below beta of 1 would be enough. But if you start seeing the Fed's actions aggressively bringing up the Treasury bill rates on the short end of the yield curve, that's when you start pulling back to stocks that have betas that are below maybe 0.5, 0.4. It also has political implications, too, on predicting what would happen in an election, if, for example, for Congress. A good economy generally tends to keep the party that is in power in power. An economy that is turning sour is a very good sign that you're going to have a switch in the political parties in power in Congress, especially in the House of Representatives, because all of them are elected every 2 years. Then in the Senate, those senators who were up for election in 2018, if the economy is doing strong, if we get through this and we don't have a lot of severe consequences, then you'll see that party probably stay in power. It's a very complex situation. A lot of factors are involved. But boiling it down, you give the people the economy they want, and or at least make them think it's the economy they want. It doesn't really have to be. You're going to have a more stable political environment. So there are implications that go beyond finance in this, and that's more for you to think about for yourself. But for your purposes, on exam 2, you need to know exactly how to answer me when I ask you, not if I ask you, when I ask you, what does beta mean? On the final exam, I will probe more along this, asking you to interpret the capital asset pricing model. Now remember, if I ask you about something like CAPM, giving me the formula gets you no points whatsoever because I don't care about the formula. You can get the formula off the intertubes. What I want to know is, do you understand how that animal works? And if you can do that, you'll get an incredible grade in the class. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.